Thank you very much, Senator Stevenson. He's my state senator, and I have to say he does a fine job representing me and my district. I appreciate the invitation to speak with you this morning. I'm about to board a plane in a little while to go back to D.C. to take another week of abuse, and we'll see where that takes us this week. You never quite know in any given week what issues exactly you might face. You know a few of them, but not all of them. This week we'll be taking up the Patriot Act reauthorization, and I have some concerns with that. We'll see how that shakes out this week. As Senator Stevenson mentioned, one of the issues that looms over us in Congress right now is the debt limit. We technically passed the debt limit last week, a week ago today. And despite prophecies of Armageddon, instantaneous and complete Armageddon, immediately after we cross that threshold, the lights are still on in that city. We still exist, and we haven't spontaneously combusted. Now, some people might attribute that to the fact that through some tricky accounting techniques, the Secretary of the Treasury has forestalled the need to do that, apparently until sometime in the first week of August. And we're told that it is the adult thing to do to raise the debt limit between now and then. Whenever I hear the word adult in that context, it reminds me of other instances in which the word adult is used very euphemistically. Sometimes it's used to modify words like bookstore or movie. And usually when it's used in that context, it's not exactly a mature adult thing to do. It's something that is, in some instances, undesirable. Now, I don't doubt for a minute that at the rate that we're spending right now, we will have to raise the debt limit at some point if we don't change the way we spend money. Nor do I doubt the fact that there are arguments against an immediate, abrupt halting of the rate at which we're spending. When you jump from a 10-story building, it's not the fall that will kill you, it's the abrupt halt at the end. And as a result of that, I think the process of balancing the budget in Congress will have to be something that takes place somewhat gradually and over the course of several years. But I don't think that we should be raising the debt limit at all until such time as we have passed a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution, ensuring, as a matter of federal constitutional law, that we cannot continue this practice of deficit spending in perpetuity. One of the reasons for that has to do with the fact that, as Milton Friedman said, inflation is taxation without legislation. It's something that can result in an increased tax burden on us as taxpayers without our actually having to legislate a tax increase. All of a sudden, everyone is paying more for everything, and they're doing that in part in order to fund the excessively expensive operations of the federal government. Now, when I say it's excessively expensive in this context, it's important to remember that we're not just talking about more expensive in nominal terms. We're not talking about expense increases that can be accounted for by normal, natural, organic inflation. For the first 150 years, roughly, of our republic, we looked on a very small percentage of the overall economy, meaning the federal government consumed between 1.5% and 4% of gross domestic product every year between 1792, the first year for which we have records on this point, up until the early 1930s, between 1.5% and 4% of GDP every single year during that time period, with only two brief exceptions. One was during the Civil War, and the second was during World War I. In both instances, we had a spike during those wars, and the spike diminished shortly after those wars, within just the first few years. All of that changed starting in the early to mid-1930s, when through New Deal programs, we crossed the 10% of GDP threshold for the first time outside the context of a war or its immediate aftermath. We've never quite retreated from that threshold. And instead, we've continued to ratchet up gradually the percentage of GDP that we consume through the federal government every single year until we got to where we are now, which is where we're spending more than 25% of gross domestic product every single year. That means that out of every dollar that moves through the American economy, a quarter of it, more than a quarter of it, goes to Washington, where it goes to die in some federal program. That's not to say that that quarter isn't doing some good. It is. It's one of the great fallacies in Washington that's used to perpetuate the growth of the federal government, is that people are pointing out, well, this isn't one of those wasteful programs. But this money, this new money that we're asking for, is going to promote something that actually does good. The problem with it is, it's almost always true. In almost every circumstance, no matter how big, how expensive, how arguably unnecessary a federal program is, you can always point to something that it does that is good. And most of the time, you can point out reasons, compelling reasons in many instances, why the beneficiary of that good is a deserving beneficiary. That, however, cannot be the standard, because if that's the standard, there really is no limit to the amount of money that Washington, D.C. can take from the American citizen, from the American taxpayer, and give it to someone else. There is no limit to the amount of your life that Washington, D.C. can't control. The example that I like to use is to remind people that as taxpayers, we work, many of us, most of us, probably all of us in this room, work several months out of every single year exclusively for the federal government, meaning the amount of taxes that we pay each year requires us to work for several months effectively without compensation or working for the federal sovereign in order just to meet our tax burden. As we do that, we're devoting time to an activity, work, that we might otherwise be able to devote to something else. Or maybe we would still be working during that time period, but we could save up that money. We could use it for something that we ourselves want to use it for. But we can't do that. And that's time, and that's money that we won't ever get back. It will never be restored to us. That's time that we could otherwise be spending with our families or reorganizing our sock drawers or doing something else of compelling importance to us. So in that sense, our tax burden is inextricably intertwined with our individual liberty. Freedom is at odds with the tax burden. To a significant degree, that's a necessary burden. It's one that we have to face. To some degree, it's one that we gladly face, at least insofar as our tax burden is attributable to our national security. We want to be able to continue to live, and to be able to continue to live, and to be able to survive and avoid a devastating attack from a foreign aggressor. We're willing to devote a portion of our lives in order to work to get money into the federal government so that we can pay for those aircraft carriers and our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. But there does come a point at which we're not just paying for national defense, and we're not just paying for only those governmental functions that only the federal government can perform, like regulating trade between the states and taking care of national property that the federal government has the right to own, and establishing and enforcing laws governing everything from trademarks, copyrights, and patents to a uniform system of weights and measures. There comes a point at which we're paying, we're devoting a portion of our lives to work for something that pays, for a program that, while doing good things for good people, is outside of that role that only the federal government can play, and outside of that role that the federal government is certainly authorized pursuant to its founding charter, that only the federal government can perform. That's why I'm glad that organizations like this one exist, to look out for what has been referred to as the forgotten man in America, that man or woman who is not clamoring for more government assistance in this area or that area, that man or woman who is working hard every day to support his or her family, to go about doing the things that every American wants to do, for himself, for his family, and for society. We have to get this problem under control, and I believe that the only way that we will ever get the problem under control is to limit the pool of resources from which the federal government draws. There is something that I've perceived in Washington in the few short months that I've been privileged to serve in the Senate so far, that as governments acquire more power, they crave additional money. They say in order to wield this power effectively, we have to have more money to do it. Then when they get that money, they've got to have something to do with it, and so they expand their power. Once that power has been expanded, they require even more money. And so you've got to have some limit, both on the substance of the power and on the source of the money. Without that, you'll have this spiraling effect that will result in the perpetual expansion of the government, not just in terms of its cost, but in terms of the degree to which it infringes on individual liberty, which it does already, by the way, every time it demands more money, either in the form of direct overt taxation or in the form of inflation. It is demanding more money from you, and it is in the process interfering with your liberty. We have had, over the last 75 years, a refusal by the courts to enforce the concrete substantive limits on the source of Congress's power. And then you've had a separate enabling factor in the sense that Congress's borrowing power, which it has under Article 1, Section 8, has been abused to the point that there is no limit to the amount of money that it has at its disposal. Such that every single year, now we're taking in about $2.2 trillion a year, and we're spending about $3.7 trillion a year. Now, this is not your mother's deficit. The deficit of just a few years ago, well, not ideal, certainly, was what we would today call a measly $150, $200 billion a year. But we're talking now about deficits in excess of $1.5 trillion every single year. Here's why that matters. Here's why that should trouble every American, and why I believe this is no longer an issue that ought to be of concern only to conservatives. Whether you were the most conservative person out there or whether you were to the left of Joseph Stalin, I'm sure we have a few of these in this room, not a whole lot, but I know Howard Stevenson is kind of a leftist, aren't you now? Just messing with you. Whether you are a liberal or a conservative, you ought to be concerned about this issue, because at the rate that we're now spending, we are just a few years away from the point where we will be having to devote $1 trillion a year, every single year, just to pay interest on our national debt. Just interest. Now, the Obama administration acknowledges this to be the case, but it insists that that point is about 10 years away. That ought to be startling in and of itself. But the Obama administration's projections are based on fairly optimistic predictions as to where interest rates will stand. I think a more realistic approach would be to acknowledge that our interest rates may well be being held anywhere from 200 to 250 to as much as 300 or 350 basis points down as a result of policies like QE2, which once they come to an end and once that pipeline has a chance to clear itself out, that gap is going to be made up. As soon as that happens, let's say that interest rates do make it up maybe 300 basis points in the next year or two, which many are predicting they will. If that happens, we will immediately add to our annual interest on national debt payments to the tune of about $450 billion a year, meaning we'll be paying a total of $700 billion a year in interest just within the next few years. Once that happens, unless we dramatically decrease the rate at which we're acquiring new debt, then we will be paying within probably 5 or 6 years $1 trillion a year in interest. That's more than we pay for national defense. That's more than we pay for Medicare and Medicaid combined. It's more than we pay on Social Security in an entire year, $1 trillion. So whether you are most concerned as an American citizen about our ability to provide for our national defense, on the one hand, as many conservatives feel, or as many liberals feel, if you're most concerned about preserving our entitlement programs, you ought to be concerned about our national debt problem. You ought to be unwilling to allow Congress to raise the national debt limit yet again, reflexively, without putting in place some kind of permanent structural spending reform to change fundamentally the way Washington, D.C. spends money. So what I've proposed is Senate Joint Resolution 10. It's a balanced budget amendment proposal that is endorsed and co-sponsored by all 47 Republicans in the United States Senate. And what it says is that Congress may not vote to raise, Congress may not spend more than it takes in any year, and Congress may not spend more than 18% of GDP in a year without a two-thirds supermajority vote in Congress. It also would require a supermajority vote to raise the debt limit. And by doing this, by placing this additional burden on Congress, it makes it still possible for Congress to engage in some deficit spending where it's necessary in order to handle some dire emergency critical to our safety, our security. But it makes it hard enough that most of the time Congress won't be able to meet that threshold. In the absence of that kind of emergent need, Congress will have to survive on what it takes in each year, and it will have to limit what it needs to 18% of GDP. This would fundamentally change the way we spend money in Washington. But without this kind of constitutional amendment, we won't get there. Here are some of the arguments made here against this proposal. What I'm saying is I will vote no on the debt limit increase, and I will break every single toy in the sandbox fighting against it, unless or until you vote in by a requisite two-thirds margin in both houses of Congress and pass along to the states for ratification of this constitutional amendment. Some of the arguments you'll hear against this idea will be to say, well, we don't want to announce that intention too early because we want to preserve our bargaining power to do something else. My response to that is, what? What else? What could possibly do this? Well, some people say we want statutory spending caps. Statutory spending caps are a good idea. They're great. I'm a huge fan of Grand Rudman Hawley's, that spending cap proposal of the statutory back in the mid-1980s. The problem with those is they have a shelf life of about 5 years. Some of them last for a much shorter period of time than that, but no matter what, they tend to get repealed after about 5 years. The other problem is Congress can always repeal its way out of any statutory spending cap. Congress, as I like to say, is a walking, breathing waiver unto itself. The minute it gets difficult to cut anything, Congress finds a way not to do it. That's why we have to take that discretion out of Congress's hands. What I'm saying with the balanced budget amendment proposal, this proposal, by the way, carries a delayed implementation clause such that it'll take 5 years post-ratification by the states for this to kick in fully. So this would give Congress a grace period of a few years, a glide path, if you will, so that Congress can bring down spending levels so that we don't have to stop abruptly. Remember, when you jump from the 10-story building, it's the abrupt halt at the end that will kill you. If you can slow yourself down with a bungee cord or something like that, then you can land safely, even though you get down relatively quickly. That's what this allows. But unless you put it in the Constitution, Congress will find a way around it. It reminds me of what was said by an ancient philosopher named Augustine of Hippo, who later became Saint Augustine, who, while in the process of converting to Christianity, uttered a prayer. A prayer in which he said, Lord, grant me chastity, but not yet. Augustine didn't want to be chaste just quite yet. He was having too much fun sowing his wild oats. He wanted to delay the moment of his chastity. Congress has delayed the moment of its chastity for far too long. And in the process, Congress is placing in grave jeopardy our currency as the preeminent, long-lasting, stable world currency. It's also placing in grave jeopardy our basic freedom, our individual liberty, our ability to choose what we do with our time and what we do with our hard-earned money that, of course, takes time, takes a portion of our lives in order to earn. That is why I'm calling this the fight of our generation. I believe that this is the kind of fight that doesn't come along very often. All the essential ingredients are there. I'm fighting every single day to get as many senators as I possibly can to join on to this pledge to oppose the debt limit increase until such time as Congress passes a balanced budget amendment. And I invite all within the sound of my voice who agree with me on this issue to try to enlist as many senators as possible in this. The fight is a difficult one, but we've got to win this one. And I'm determined to do it. I ask for your assistance in doing so. Thank you very much for letting me talk to you this morning.